Hi there, and welcome to the Growing Opportunities podcast series. I am Michelle Roberge.
And I am Megan Darcy.
We are the agriculture coordinators for the regional district of Bulkley Chaco.
We are small-scale farmers with a keen interest in agriculture, and we're excited to be using this format to communicate information about regional agriculture to the broader community. This podcast series will touch on different agriculture topics important to new farmers and producers wanting to diversify their farm operations.
If you have questions about these podcasts or anything agriculture in the regional district, please go to rdbn.bc.ca, click on the agriculture link, and you'll find our contact information there.
We hope that you enjoy this podcast series on growing opportunities in the RDBN.
The RDBN is providing this podcast as a public service. It is neither a legal interpretation nor a statement of government policies. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the RDBN. The views expressed by staff and guests are their own and do not represent the opinion of the RDBN or any of its directors. Presenters are not subject matter experts, and information presented should be verified by certified professionals prior to informing business or legal decisions.
Hey there. I'm Megan Darcy, one of the agriculture coordinators for the regional district of Bulkley Chaco. The focus of this episode of the Growing Opportunities podcast is on small-scale livestock production. This episode was a bit more difficult to pull together, as small-scale livestock production isn't just a huge topic, but small-scale also has different meanings depending on who you're talking with and the context of the discussion. For our purposes, however, small-scale is basically all of the livestock production in our region, with the exception of some of the larger cow-calf operations and dairies. The agriculture coordinator position falls under economic development at the regional district, so although people who are homesteading have a lot of the same farm management practices and challenges, there's an underlying assumption for this podcast that livestock are part of a small farm business. So for my first podcast guest, I'd like to introduce Dina Lear. She's a first-generation farmer, and she and her husband, Brad, have Graham Acres Homestead in Terrace. Welcome, Dina.
Thanks, Megan, for having me.
So what made you and Brad decide to start farming?
Well, the journey started a while ago with this dream of having animals and a homestead. And we were on a small city lot, and it started with a raspberry bush. And from there, it grew into 300 garlic bulbs. And from there, we had one or two hives. And then we got five chickens, and we realized we either needed to get real with homesteading or just be content with what our space allowed for. And this property came up for us, and we just knew in our hearts this was the right step. Being first generation farmers, we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into, but it's been the right decision all along.
Oh, that's awesome. What kind of livestock do you keep?
Well, it started with, like I said, the chickens, and then down the road, the chicken egg farm had closed, and the couple were retiring, and so they gave us their chickens. And then there was a post on Facebook, did someone want goats? And I said to my husband Brad, I said, you know, we should get goats. And he said, oh, well, why not, we've got the space. And then all of a sudden this addiction for goats came about. And so on our farm currently we have 23 or 24 goats. We've got three cows, two are calves and one's a pregnant heifer. Then we've got five piglets, about 75 chickens, 25 ducks, and about, I want to say, 30 rabbits.
Wow, that's incredible. So what do you do with most of it? Is most of it for meat, or how do you manage that?
So we raise proteins. So we raise the pigs for pork. We raise the chickens for eggs. We raise the bees for honey, and we raise the goats. We started off with goats as a meat, but soon became addicted to the milk. And so we raise them predominantly for the milk. And then the boys, of course, the wethers for goat protein. And then the calves are for protein as well. The rabbits are for protein. And then When the weather's not so cold, we do get chicks and pullets for turkey and chicken meat.
Oh, okay. So that must mean that because you're quite a distance from the abattoir in Tupla, so do you slaughter on farm?
We do. We slaughter on farm. We went through the process initially with Northern Health to become certified with our slaughter license D. And it has changed to the ministry most recently, I believe, in October, November. And so we're going through that process as well with them to continue with our slaughter license. And the reason being was just, like you said, the nearest abattoir was 3 hours from us. And so for us, it's really important for animal husbandry to treat the animal with as much respect as possible. And we just didn't feel like putting them into a truck to haul them to their end was appropriate. And so we do it on site as ethically and as humanely as we can.
Yeah, it's hard too, because it's not just driving the animals into the abattoir, but then, you know, once the process is finished, then you have to like deal with going, well, depending on if you're doing chickens or red meat, like then you have to go back and pick them up. And so like, it's not logistically, it's pretty tricky.
It is. And here in Terrace, we're really fortunate. We have a local butcher who is about 3 blocks from us. And so on processing day, you know, we coordinate, are you ready for the animal? Yes. Then, you know, we put the animal down. Our children are involved. We thank the animal for its meat. Then we process it and take it to the butcher, which is, like I said, 3 blocks away.
Yeah, it's good that you, I mean, that's one of our issues here is we have a little bit of a bottleneck at the cut and wrap stage. So it's nice for you guys to have that there.
And it's a challenge for a lot of small producers. As much as we all want to produce local, the challenge is we don't have enough qualified individuals, like you said, to cut and wrap.
So tell me about the goats.
I'm very interested in learning
yeah, more about this project.
So this project started, most projects for me always start out of some kind of misstep. And for us, it was the misstep was we, our goat had a stillborn. And so in that grieving process, I'm looking at my doe, my nanny, who has now had a stillborn and her udders are utterly full of milk. And I'm looking at the rest of the herd who are about to go into kidding season as well. And I thought, oh gosh, what if one of the moms rejects their child or their kid? And now I need colostrum. And so I got my nanny, Snickerdoodle is her name, onto the stand. And together we, you know, developed this relationship where I would milk her twice a day. And we had all this milk on hand. And I just said, well, maybe I should make some cheese. We love cheese. And from there it blossomed. And all of a sudden it was like, okay, so how do we do this legitimately? And then COVID hit. And it was a real gem because COVID hit, I didn't have to fly down to Vancouver to get my dairy plant license certification. They offered an online course. And so I did the online dairy plant certification course for the BC CDC and then went down this rabbit hole of certification. There's no real template to follow. And so it's kind of a farm by farm process. And so we're what you would consider a producer processor. We produce the milk and we process the milk. And the reason we went goat over cow is that with cow, as you may be aware, you require quota. And per head of quota, it's based on buttermilk fat, and it can each head approximately cost $35,000 a year through the milk board. And that's just something that we couldn't justify. But there's no quota requirement for dairy goats. And so here we are. Now, this process has been going on for about 2 years back and forth, getting all of the requirements approved, but we have been pre-approved by the BC CDC to start construction for our plant. And knowing that our nearest plant that produces goat milk or any cheese for that matter is Salmon Arm. So it's quite a distance. And if we want to become more sustainable and have some food sovereignty, dairy is also very important.
So you must have had some sort of approved facilities for doing your on-farm slaughter, but I'm assuming that the creamery is like a completely different project.
It's a completely different project. So our animals are processed in a different building. Right. We've converted our shop. What we ended up doing was with all of the rigmarole of building on ALR, we decided to get a sea can and we put said sea can into our shop. And so the sea can, instead of it becoming a new build, became a piece of equipment. So our creamery, in essence, is a piece of equipment.
Oh, okay. And then are you able to use the metal sides of the sea can as like disinfectable surfaces, or do you have to build kind of like into the, like use that sort of as your outside wall and then go from there?
We've used it as our outside wall because it's not, we don't know if it's stainless steel or not. And so, right. And it was dented in areas. And so the thing with having a dairy plant is that you have to have a washable surface, right. Should be stainless steel. The floor has to be impermeable, so it has to be concrete with an epoxy coating with the required drainage. And so there's a lot of, the sea can's a great vessel, but it's not the end all. There's a lot of construction that still needs to go into it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Plus you need all of the equipment, like the processing equipment.
Correct. You need the pasteurizer. You need the bulk milk tank. You need all the stainless steel equipment. Yes, it's, although in theory, it sounds like, oh, this is a simple little project. we're at this point, $100,000 into the project. So
yeah. So you're
committed. It's not cheap and it's not easy.
Yeah. No, I can imagine because when you get through the other side of this and you start processing, are you then planning on selling it into the local community then?
We're going to go through the local farmers market. At this point, we're considered a micro dairy plant.
Right.
At this point, we're producing about 16 liters of goat milk a day. And that equates to a small amount of consumable cheese. Cheese is the curdling of the casein. So you get the cheese curds and then the whey, of course, that we use to feed the pigs. So the amount of cheese you get off 16 liters is a fraction. And so we don't have enough. And then the other challenge is that it's seasonal, and helping people understand that seasonality of food, just like trees produce fruit only at one point of the year, goats only produce milk from April until November, and then you have to dry them off so that they can produce the goat again, and then you go back into the season of goat milk. So there's a seasonality of it, and at this point our market will be the farmers market.
That makes sense. So how many goats do you think you'll have to keep to sort of maintain enough of a milk supply to do cheese for the farmers market?
So at this point, our business plan started off with 7 to 8 goats, which is what we're milking right now. And then we'll look at the condition of the goat kids in the fall to see if they are mature enough to be bred, or if we need to wait until the spring to breed them. And so ultimately our goal is to get to 16 to 20 head of milking goats while producing goat kids year over year to replenish the ones that get too old, and then to help sell dairy goats into the local communities. Our goats are licensed and registered. And so that's something that we also have as an ability to offer the community will be breeding stock.
Wow, that's amazing. So what breed are they?
They are Saanen. They're a purebred Saanen goat, which is a really good milking goat for their not only the volume, but the buttermilk fat.
Wow, that sounds like quite an adventure.
It is. It's, you know what? If you had asked me 5 years ago, so do you see yourself making cheese? I would have said, with what? And then if you told me goat milk, I would have said, really? No, I don't think so. But, you know, future self me, now I'm thinking, yep, this is something that, you know, we can create. This will be something that we do for years to come. And then if our children were so blessed that they want to take it over, that's great. And if not, then someone who may want to take it over down the road.
Yeah, somebody with a passion for goats and isn't lactose intolerant. Right? Right on. Okay, well, thank you very much for sharing your story with us today. And yeah, really appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Megan, for having the interest in what we're doing here in Terrace.
So as part of this podcast, I have a small farm business. So I'm just going to walk around and talk a little bit about my own farm and about some of the things that I've done to try and improve my own farm management. So I'm just coming up to the chickens here. I have two different kinds of chickens normally. I raise broilers, but I don't happen to have any right now. But I always have about 15 to 20 laying hens that I raise just so that we have eggs for ourselves. Right now, I have a disproportionate number of roosters in the flock because I raised some Buff Orpingtons with one of the last batches of meat birds I did last year. And they come unsexed, so I wasn't able to just get hens. So now I have three quite beautiful roosters wandering in and amongst all my hens, which is mostly fine, although I might pull them out later on this summer, so just to give my hens a little bit of a break. I don't know if you can hear them, but they're clucking away. They're quite happy that it's a nice warm day outside. Okay, I'm just walking around now. We have several sheep on the farm as well. I have a younger ram, I have some older rams, and then I have a flock of about 20 ewes that I have normally bred in the latter part, well, I guess actually early winter, to try and have May lambs, because it's just way nicer to have lambs when it's warm, because we have some infrastructure, but mostly we lamb outside, so with shelters. This year, we had a ram get into the ewe flock unexpectedly. He made it through one of my gates. So we had lambs in kind of all different sort of unscheduled times throughout the winter. So we're going to do a little bit of a reset here and then start our breeding program again in the December of this year. Yeah, and so because of that, I have a maternity pen that still has a ewe in it with a couple of her babies. She's talking, asking for grain because she's getting grained on a regular basis because she's still nursing pretty heavily. I have llamas in with the sheep as guardians. I actually have three llamas. I have two female llamas that are in with my main flock. And then I have their dad, who's an intact male. And he is not in with them because llamas don't go into estrus the same way that sheep do. They're induced ovulators. So basically it's the act of mating that stimulates ovulation. And so they can be bred any time of year. So my male llama is kept to himself for the most part. Kind of the lot in life for the intact males on most farms because otherwise you'd just be having babies all the time unpredictably, which is a little bit harder from a management point of view. And then on the less commercial side of the farm, we have a couple of horses and we have some dogs and we have some cats and cats that have adopted us. We actually didn't even need to go find them. They found us. So I have a good size meat bird barn that I use for raising broilers. I don't have any birds in there right now, but basically how I've done it or sort of managed it over the years is that I have a space at the back that is really well insulated and acts as my brooder. And I just use heat lamps for the brooder, but it's so well insulated that I don't need very many. And I usually raise about 100 broilers at one time. And then, so once they're a little bit bigger and they're too big to all fit in the brooder anymore, then I have two sides of the barn that have just short fencing up so that I can lean over top and do waters and feeders. And so they go in there until they're essentially big enough that they can come outside. And for the longest time, I had quite a large hoop shelter that I used to put the birds in. And so I could do quite a number of birds in the summertime because I could start in the brooder and then I could move them out into the main part of the barn and then start more chicks in the brooder and then kind of like keep that cycle moving because as birds came outside, there would be more room left in the barn to raise babies up to kind of like teenagers and then outside. And that worked really well. But the hoop shelter started to fall apart. So I'm now looking at having to build different exclosures for them outside. I find that just in terms of predator control, etc., it's just better to have them outside have them kind of enclosed outside. I do have some of that poultry netting, and I do actually use the netting around the hoop shelter just to prevent dogs and foxes and coyotes and stuff and bears to some degree, although I'm not sure the charge is strong enough for bears because it wouldn't take much for them to get into there. It's not exactly a fortress or anything. So I'm still working towards figuring out what the next exclosure should look like. And then behind the barn, I have crates that I actually bought used ages ago that I use to transport the birds to the slaughterhouse. That's pretty much my farm operation, and it's little. It's just over 10 acres, and we do have a vegetable garden here, but I haven't been gardening for the last little while because A, time management, and B, we don't have as much water as I would like in some of the drier years, and obviously the animals would get priority over the garden. Anyways, thanks. That's my farm tour for today. So I'm here with Manfred Whitwer. He and his family own W Diamond Ranch. Welcome, Manfred.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
So we're talking about livestock production. So I guess my first question is, how long have you and your family been raising livestock?
So we've been here in Telqua on our ranch since 1994, so 28 years. And yeah, we had livestock before that in Europe, so in Switzerland where we grew up. But here in Telqua, it's 28 years, yeah. When we started out, we really went what most people do here, cow-calf operations, selling calves in the fall. And it was okay, you know. We're, having cows calving and working off the farm, logging and stuff. And then I think for us, the big challenge and the big game changer was VSE, like the mad cow disease. That right. Really got... There, things went so bad, you just couldn't make money on the farm. And that kind of did make a lot of changes for us then.
Yeah, and so now you guys are direct marketing only, right?
Yes, so we do direct marketing only. And then, so we do, besides the beef, we do lamb, we do pork and goats. And
yeah. And I remember you had a foray into chickens at some point.
We did chickens for a while, yeah. Had to give up something.
Yeah, that's right.
Couldn't do everything anymore. Yeah.
So what, out of all of those things that you mentioned, do you have like a favorite?
I still like the cows the best. No, it's, the beef is what we really strive for, and that's where our main focus is.
And you had, do you still have goats?
Yes. Yes and no. We were not going to do goats anymore, and then people keep asking for goat meat, so, and then I just bought, I think, a dozen here 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay. So you're back into the goat business.
So I got into goats, yeah.
That's yeah. Nice. So you manage the abattoir
yes.
in Tapua, and also have a cut and wrap here at the ranch. Maybe we should talk a little bit about the process that people need to go through, because I know the abattoir can be quite busy, particularly in the fall. So should we talk a little bit about, like, transportation to the abattoir, booking your animals into the abattoir, and making sure that you have cut and wrap services and stuff like that?
Yes. So, yeah, that is definitely, now it has become a challenge over the last number of years, but especially that prime time in the fall, like, let's say, September to end of November, for getting a spot for your animals to be processed. And that can right. be anything from beef to pigs and lambs, and even then chickens becomes a challenge when you still have chickens and turkeys to be processed. So
right.
so yeah, so the big thing is these days, I always tell people, so find a spot for cut and wrap, and we normally tell people where they can go and, you know, what is available or who is the cut and wrap, and then they have to talk to the cut and wrap themselves and then call back to the abattoir to book their animal in. So and just to make it clear, there is a so in Smithers we have the sausage factory who is probably the biggest processor in the area. Then there's myself here in Double Diamond Ranch, we process, and then there's DLM Meats in Houston, and then there's the Butcher on the Raceway who does also process. So yeah, that's kind of the options people have, but we have done slaughtered animals who people then take to Terrace, do a cut and wrap there, or even back to as far as Prince George. I've had people taking meat.
Right.
Yeah.
Like as far as the process goes, like they bring their animals in the day before, right?
Yes, the day before, live, the animal has. Surprising how many people don't understand that you have to bring the animal live.
Yeah, still kicking.
yeah. And then we have an inspector on site that has to see the animal before it's killed, and then an inspector who is there through the whole process to ensure that the animal is actually good healthy to eat. Yes, and obviously the inspector is somewhat responsible to on our operation about cleanliness and that we don't mess something up that way. So
right.
Yeah.
Well, and just sometimes it's hard to see the details when you're getting through your day, and it's a pretty production-based system,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So yeah, no, that makes sense. So obviously I can't not do this interview without talking about chickens. Since chickens is what I raise. So I know I have my own crates, but you guys have some crates for rent as well. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. We have crates for rent that people can come and pick up and then bring their birds in. And yeah, the people don't understand how important it is, even on how important, like on chickens, how important it is that they're transported properly, because the crates are designed that the chickens are kind of crouched down and stable when you're driving, and because when you have them, and I see it all the time when people bring them in bigger crates or even in trailers or whatever, because they, when you drive down the highway and there's too much room for them, they will flap and they bruise their wings and all of that stuff. So it is, you know, some people think, oh, just chickens get crowded in those crates, but there is a reason why they're designed the way they are to actually keep them from hurting themselves.
Do you clean them, or do people have to clean them separately?
Yeah, no, we do wash the crates thoroughly after use, and then we actually sanitize them. But it's always been important to sanitize the crates when they go out to different farms, that you don't spread any kind of disease. And that's what a lot of people don't realize. You know, they will use a crate from their neighbor or whatever, and right. They just, you can spread nasty disease around really, really fast. And there is actually a rule in the inspection manual that once an animal is dropped off at the abattoir, and it doesn't matter if it's a chicken or if it's a cow or a lamb or whatever, once it's there, it's not supposed to be going from there out again. Once it's unloaded, it's supposed to stay there.
Yeah, and going back to the chickens, I was thinking about this while you were talking about booking dates for cut and wrap and stuff. I know for myself, when I've been ordering my chicks for the last few years, I have been booking the slaughter dates like at the same time.
So for me, when they get the chicks or order the chicks, and they call me and we kind of book it in, you know, to what they think, how long it's going to take them to grow them. At least for me, I have those chickens recorded. I know they're around. And then when you give me a call, you know, 2 weeks before that and say, I don't think they're big enough, or sometimes people call too and say, I think they're getting too big. I need to, mm-hmm. you know, move them. It's, for me, it's a lot easier to move things around when I know they're around than when somebody calls me and said, I have 200 chickens. They need to be done next week.
And, like, and you're like, okay, well, when they invent a 48-hour day.
And it's gotten better now over the last 2 years because people realized that. And it's not really the abattoir that's the bottleneck. Like, it's right. in that regard, then it's the cut and wrap. People just need to be able to have it booked somewhere for cut and wrap.
Yeah. No, that totally makes sense. Because I know the chickens, you're able to do cut and wrap basically there on
yes,
site.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, and actually that leads us into the next, one of the last questions I had. And that was, like, what information should people have when they come to the plant with their critters?
For me, the big thing is what do they want on the label? Do they want their personal name? Do they want a farm name? And then an address. Like, if you do a name, you should have a phone number, address on it. I think that's
yeah.
required.
Yeah, for traceability.
Yeah. And then obviously price. Yes, there's a lot of people who obviously only want it for themselves, so they don't care about price. But for my labeler to actually print, I need to put a price on. So then we just normally put a generic price on.
Oh, okay.
So once you start processing for cutting up, so how do you want to cut? Do you want, and how many pieces in a package and all of that? Yes.
Right.
And there's maybe one thing that once we cut up chickens, what people have carcasses of the chickens. Do they want the carcasses back? And what are they going to do with that? And,
right.
But going into the other species, so in beef, cows, like, people need, you need to have an RFID tag for cows. You need a Form 3, that's a livestock manifest. And that's really the two things you for sure need to have when you bring in a beef.
So what about pigs?
So on pigs, you were supposed to have the PicTrace tags that you need to order from PicTrace Canada, I believe.
Okay.
And then you have to fill out the form when you get there, or you can do it before. I think you can download it off the website too and fill it up before you come. But we have forms there that I make people then fill out with your personal information, like your where you got the pigs from, basically.
Okay.
Or where you loaded them, so your address and name, and then they want license plate numbers from your vehicle and trailer and
wow, okay.
all of that. So
sorry, do they need a tag or they don't need
there's
a tag?
Then they do need a tag.
Oh, they
yes.
do need a tag.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah, yeah, we have to record the tags, and then we have to submit these papers within, actually, I think 2 days we have to send those in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sheep, we have
sheep. Yes, sheep. We have a requirement too. They're supposed to have the sheep. What is it called? Sheep.
Yeah.
It's, trace or
yeah.
No.
They're tagged similar to, but in the past I've got mine from the Canadian Wool Growers.
Yes, you have to order them from the Wool Growers Association. Yeah. They're not available in town, so like the pick. Pick tags, you have to order them, and that sometimes people forget and all of that. And then there's one big thing on the lambs or the sheep, what people don't realize, like in the pigs and the beef, we as the abattoir have to report the tags, and they get retired that way. On the lambs or the sheep, the producer has to retire the tax. I cannot retire the tax at the abattoir. Yeah.
Is that new?
No.
Oh, jeepers.
Been like that for quite a long time.
I better get on
that. Yeah. Like we tried to retire them, and then for a while it actually worked, and here now the last few, number of years it's just rejected. So
okay.
Yeah, yeah. So the producer has to retire the tax. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, yes. Well, I mean, I guess that speaks to record keeping.
Yes.
Making sure that you have those numbers. Right?
Yeah, yeah. So there is another thing I would like to talk about then when we're talking about small scale, and that's animal husbandry.
Right.
I find it's sometimes really hard to deal with that aspect of it because I guess for me then, because I grew up with animals all my life, I can see, how an animal is doing. And when people haven't had that experience, it's sometimes, I think, hard to see for people what's going on. If you're feeding an animal twice a day and you can miss it if you don't know what to look for. And,
yeah.
And it's just, so I find that... And, and let's say, so speak about pigs. There's two things that normally happen. And one is the pig is overfed and now you're going to have,
A lot of fat.
Yeah. Overabundance of fat. What, to me, okay, the loss is on you. The pig had a good life.
Yeah, sure did.
So it's not so bad. And then you have the other extreme where you have pigs who are just about malnourished and you don't end up with a good product at the end. Yeah. And then somehow people think that it's the processor who wrecked their product. And, so we get that a lot. So
might be a good time to talk about body scoring, because that's a really common way of telling for a lot of animals, not all of them.
Yeah.
Pigs would be harder, but body scoring for sheep and cattle, and I mean, I know horses aren't part of this discussion, but also works on horses, because lots of times some of those animals, particularly if they're not handled a lot, and so you can't get your hands on them until it's time to load or treat them for something, but like, it is important to try, I think. Like, you can get deceived by big wool coats or even hair sheep, I've found, like they can really fluff out. And same with the cattle, like they can get a really decent winter coat on them that kind of doesn't show you what's really happening.
Yeah.
Like, is there a time when, even if your cattle are a little bit wild, you could at least get your hands on the ribs and just sort of see what the fat cover is?
I guess that touching it is a little harder, but just to be able to see, how filled out are they, you look at their back end and see if there's actually some muscle there or is it just kind of sloughed in.
How prominent are their hip bones?
Yes, all of that. This definitely makes a difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
And chickens too. Like, I always tell people, pick up a few chickens turkeys, I know a turkey producer, she said, grab a turkey and feel their breasts and you feel if they're filled out or if it's still that bone is still really prominent in the front. And
yeah, for sure.
So all of those things are definitely important. Chickens, I always say, yeah, if you're unsure, just put them on, take one and put it on a scale, you know, or a few and see. And you kind of, on a chicken, you probably lose 25% in weight.
Yeah, the different breeds makes a big difference.
Yes.
Yeah. So, like, if you're going for more heritage-type style birds or dual-purpose birds, then, yeah, what they'll look like is very different than if you're going for the commercial Cornish crosses or Giants or whatever they're called.
Yes.
Now.
Yep.
Yeah, because I know I have a way of picking. I do the commercial birds, and I know when I go to pick them up, I can tell, like, by how far apart my hands are and, like, whether or not I can kind of barely get my hands there, that they're the right weight.
Yeah, and that's just, those things are important for people to kind of learn. And you know, I've seen people who they can have a disaster one year, and then they learn from it, and they gets better. And I have had, sadly enough, I have people who just never seem to be able to learn from their mistakes.
Well, yeah. It's probably not as uncommon as we'd like to think.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Manfred. Yeah. We really appreciate having this conversation. And we're really grateful, obviously, as an agriculture community, that you do as much work that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you again to my guest, Dina Lear from Graymaker's Homestead in Terrace, and Manfred Whitwer, who with his family runs W. Diamond Ranch and Buckley Valley Custom Slaughter, for speaking with me today. This episode was hosted by me, Megan Darcy, and edited by Pamela Hawson. Our liability waiver was read by Jason Llewellyn, and artwork is by Michelle Roberge. The music for the Growing Opportunities podcast can be found at the Free Music Archive. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast episode. And please, if you haven't already, take a listen to some of the other podcasts that we have in this series. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Growing Opportunities podcast series. This and other Growing Opportunities podcasts can be accessed through all the major podcast apps and on the RDBN and CICK websites. The link to the RDBN website is rdbn.bc.ca. Have a great day and keep growing.